All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 22 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing here with the story of Egypt, and we're trying to figure out a little bit more of the particulars, the details, the nitty-gritty of the structure of pharaonic society. And by understanding that, we're going to be in a good position to understand how come the pyramid builders went away. And we can understand that concept in two ways. If we're thinking about Egypt as the culture of the pyramid builders, which is really the essential present-centric significance of archaic Egypt, from our point of view, this is the one thing that is of continuous or remaining present day interest when it comes to archaic Egypt, an otherwise extinct civilization that we could pretty much ignore, and we really wouldn't be losing anything. So for historical reasons, the thing that we're interested in is the pyramids. So that culture of the pyramid builders is going to go away in two senses. Eventually, the whole thing is going to fall away, some of this, the features of Egyptian society that we're talking about are responsible for that. But very specifically, the culture of pyramid building, and that essentially Egyptian culture, is going to die an earlier death. So the civilization is going to continue. It's still going to be there, and it's going to be there for an amazingly long time. I mean, in some measure, I think you could say that archaic Egyptian society survived in various ways all the way until the rise of Islam. So we're talking circa 622 AD. Now, by that point, it had really, really been curtailed and transformed and really radically pulled back, and had been changed by the Romans, and had been changed by the Greeks, and been changed by the Persians, and so on. So by the time you get to Islam, there's really so little of it left, and it's intermixed with all kinds of other stuff. But it is still shockingly persistent. We're talking about something that began circa 3000 BC. And if we put as a final, death date for the extinction date for the civilization, if we put it at circa 622 AD, it's a little after that because it's not, the very moment that Muhammad comes on the scene. But wow, that is still a shockingly long time. What we're going to see is that after the age of the pyramids, which is really only the first, there's only about a 500 year span within that whole time. The rest of it is very unremarkable. There's nothing kind of special about ancient Egypt. There certainly is nothing present-centrically important. So there's a lot of stuff is what it ends up being. It ends up being 3,000 years worth of stuff. So we're not going to spend an awful lot of time on it. We just aren't, because that would be not just an error, it would be worse than that. I mean, it would really be a serious waste of time, and a betrayal of the essence of the, the purpose of History at Our House. We're not here to accumulate a bunch of stuff. We're here to focus on stuff that's still present relevant, concerning the past. And so Egypt only has so much of that to give us. But it does have some, and so we're going to look at today. We're going to look at that again, the structure of Egyptian society, and the structure of pharaonic society, and talk about in particular, try to dig a little bit more into its features, try to analyze its strengths and weaknesses, and then I'll tell you how it failed, at least for the first time. So that's kind of our subject for today. How this whole system fell apart completely. And then Egypt went through a really extensive period in which, it was chaos. So by comparison to the relative order and structure of what had come before, it was a really devastating time. and it fell apart. And when it came back, it was never the same. So we're never going to see, after the age of pyramids, we're never going to see pyramids again. We're still going to have pharaohs, and we're still going to have the Egyptian religion and so on. But what we're going to see of the Egypt after the time of the pyramid builders is a society that just really doesn't have much to say for itself. And, you know, nothing that really stands out, nothing that is really special, exceptional, or new. It's stagnant, and it's just kind of waiting for something to come over and, you know, tip it over and surpass it. And that's exactly what happens. Pretty soon, history does come up with something more dynamic, something more progressive, and then Egypt is gone. All right, so let's take a look now at this Egyptian society. And we're going to focus on a diagram. Just wanted to point out before we do that your class notes are available. So they're collected here, week 7 and 8 together for the junior high class. So definitely one of the things you should be doing this week is just reading those over, giving those a reading to make sure that everything there is clear. And that will set up this topic, right? In the class notes, I talk about the whole Nilocentric society, the whole challenge of Egyptian pharaonic rule, and so on. So that sets the context for the next thing that we're going to look at here, which I'm going to bring up now. So I have a diagram here that I've constructed, it's hard to fit on one page, but those of you who have studied European history with me before will be familiar with the right-hand side of this diagram. And so what I've tried to do here is take Egyptian society as well as I know it represent it in a similar fashion, because it has similar features. There are similarities and differences, and they're all interesting and worth pursuing to some extent. And they will help us, especially for those of you who are familiar with European history, it'll help you to make sense of this period that we are going to encounter, which is the disintegration of the pharaonic society, the disintegration of the pharaonic system and how it came about. Okay, so I'm going to draw a comparison side by side here. If you are not familiar with the European society of the Middle Ages, if there's anything on the right-hand side that is a big, you know, empty mental file folder for you, please don't hesitate. Okay, I can probably fill in any gaps you might have in your own kind of knowledge about history pretty quickly if there's something that you want to go over. Okay, but just for the sake of setting up the context here, what we're going to do, what I'm hope to do, especially by putting these two things side by side, is to generate a little bit more present-centric outcome for everybody who wants to study Egyptian history, okay, at this level. And the present-centric outcome that we're looking for here is not so much an insight into how the world came to be the way that it is today, okay? There's different kinds of present-centric value that we can derive from history. The present-centric value that we're going to focus on here with this type of diagram is of a different order. It is the ability to identify patterns in historical societies and to use those patterns to arrive at a general understanding of how human societies are organized, how they work, what their features are, and in certain cases, right, how they don't work, or why some approaches to organizing societies are superior to others, how inferior ones don't suit, you know, human needs, and so on and so forth. And in other words, what this gradually, if you're able to do it, if you're able to collect this type of information and generalize about history, What you become ready to do is, to put it bluntly, think. You become ready to think about important topics in human life, especially politics. Okay? Human life is very crucially political. And yes, our society today is very different from either of the two sides of this diagram. But your ability to think in terms of general terms, in terms to think conceptually about models of society will be the difference for you personally in terms of how well you can understand your own society and function well within it. And so this is a big one. This is one part of history that we really want to try to work on, in addition to seeing how society came to be, seeing how the world came to be the way that it is. That other present-centric value is, how does the world work? See, those are two different kinds of questions. And they really, really importantly go together. Okay? Value, present-centric value number one, I call insight. If you want to just put a word on it, right? Apply a single term to it, I call it insight. Insight into how the world came to be the way that it is. The ability to explain the things you see around you by historical causation, to be able to say, I know why this is the way that it is. Okay, that's insight. And that is the primary function of history, to explain how things got to be the way that they are, in their good aspects, in their bad aspects, and so on. But then, the allied value that we are going to try to shoot for here, the other thing that you want to be able to do with history, insight is not enough. Insight is fabulous. It's awesome, and I love to be able to develop more and more insight into the world. But it's not enough. The other value that we need to pursue increasingly, and you guys are at that level now where you can start to do this, is, and again, to use a single word, instruction. And by instruction, I mean the meaning of history. The lessons of history. What history teaches us, not just about how we got here, but what it shows us about human life as such. Because it does. There is no other objective basis for learning what history has to teach us. There's no other basis, because it is the record of humanity. It is, period. There's no other source. This is what human beings have done. So if you want to say how human beings should live, for instance, on what basis? If you want an objective basis, in other words, a factual and scientific basis for talking about human values and human societies, there's only one place you can get it. From studying what human beings have done. And then generalizing about that, conceptualizing the problems of humanity, and then you're really off to the races. Then you can really do some interesting thinking. Okay, so this is, you know, this is huge here. I know that for some of you it's an early stage to be thinking in those terms, but my job here is to challenge you and to take you as far as you can go in terms of understanding history. And so to establish a pattern and to help you think in terms of, you know, comparing similarities and differences between different societies, we got Europe on the right and Egypt on the left. Okay? Europe on the right, Egypt on the left. And these are societies, they're both extinct societies. So right off the bat, there's something interesting. They're both extinct societies. Neither of these systems exists anymore. So that then, doesn't that lead to all kinds of interesting questions? I mean, for you, I mean, if you're willing to think, if you're willing to then conceptualize, then you have a lot to work with And I could also put Japanese imperial society, you know, over on one side or the other. And I could put the Chinese imperial system on one side or the other. And I could put a variety of other ones. We could put the Mesopotamian system that we're going to encounter later as well. All very similar, all essentially the same, all extinct. So, okay. Wow, that's pretty interesting. All right, now what does that say? I mean, how much can we say based on that? How do we compare that to what we have today? What's good, what's not? It's certainly not easy to talk about these issues. It's certainly very challenging to do so. But if you do learn history properly, you can talk about these issues intelligently. Okay, so let's start with Egypt for the time being. We'll focus primarily on Egypt. And let's start here with this really, really crucial combination at the top, right, which is somewhat unique, but not entirely, not to the Egyptian system. We can talk. Anybody who knows European systems can try to bring up counterexamples and interesting comparisons to make, because there are plenty of them. But let's talk about the pharaoh and the vizier here, because that's where we left off last time. Tell me about the pharaoh and the vizier. The pharaoh is the figurehead. Okay? Take it from there. Abby.
Pharaoh, all of the citizens of ancient Egypt worship him as a god king and admire him. And to him, he is their king and has all the power, but they think he has all the power, but the vizier is the person who actually has all the power.
Okay, why?
He's the person who actually goes out and talks to the people and has the power to do what he wants with them, whatever it is that the pharaoh says, because the pharaoh won't allow anyone to see him because he does not want them to figure out he is a normal person.
Okay. So a lot of good stuff there. A lot of good stuff there. It's naturally because it's putting you on the spot. The formulation's a little bit rough around the edges. Okay, so we have to, let's see what we can do with what Abby said there, because there's a lot of good stuff. One thing is the vizier has all the real power. Does anybody want to kind of edit that a little bit? Kind of, we got to be careful about how we characterize this relationship. Because he's the one that actually interacts with the people and the, you know, and with the rest of the people in the society. Can we flesh that out a little bit? Because we got to be careful of that. Is that true? If so, in what way? What are the qualifiers we need to put on that to understand this? Alexander?
Well, the pharaoh is supposed to be making all of the decisions, like all of the big decisions. And whenever the pharaoh decides to do something, the vizier is supposed to follow his orders, but he's the one who actually enacts it and, like, talks to the people and says, okay, we're going to send this many soldiers to this place and whatever.
Right.
There are several things that can happen. Like, the pharaoh can say something and the vizier can tell all the people to do something slightly different. And also, the vizier can just do, like, minor things that he hopes the pharaoh won't notice without being asked to do that at all. And all kinds of things like that.
All right, nice. Nice, I like your little... Go ahead.
If he gets corrupt enough, he can just not follow the pharaoh's orders and try to overthrow him or something.
All right. So I like the subtleties of your examples of things that can go wrong, right? Okay, but again, we've got to accept that we have to really envision this relationship in as real terms as possible, right? And your point about, I like your point about how he can do subtle things, small things that the pharaoh won't notice. That's the reality of it, right? We don't want to get into the trap of oversimplifying the relationship and saying, well, the vizier has all the power, right? And the pharaoh only is a symbol, or because he's stuck or he doesn't want to be seen. Well, that's not true. He does want to be seen, but he only wants to be seen to a certain extent. He wants to have a mystique. Okay, there's an aura about the pharaoh, right? The pharaoh is more than a person. The pharaoh is an institution. The pharaoh is an idea. So it has to be kind of nurtured and maintained within the culture. And so he has to appear in public in only certain ways and be really impressive and be way up on the stage. And there's a lot of soldiers and a lot of loud music and whatever, right? And it's got to be really impressive. And you know, they're building the pyramids, and that's got to be really impressive. So there's all of this, all of these things that are tied together that surround the pharaoh and make him this figurehead. But there's a delicate relationship with the vizier. And so the vizier can do a certain amount by himself, and he won't, and you know, but okay, keep going here. What are the dangers of being the vizier? I mean, it's good. It's in some cases, right? Because there's some real power there. There's just physical, you know, reality of him being the one who does the talking, who gives the orders, and so on. Theo?
Well, if something goes wrong, like the vizier does something and it doesn't turn out how he expected, mm-hmm. and the pharaoh blames it on him,
okay,
he could get in trouble really fast.
Okay, and getting in trouble with the pharaoh amounts to...
pretty much death.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't too many options up at that level, right? I mean, if you get fired, when you're the vizier, you don't get fired, right? I mean, basically, presumably something like you get your head cut off or something equally unpleasant. Okay, just a challenge question for some of you veterans here of European history. Can anybody recall any similar examples in European societies, and some even exist to this day to a certain extent, of kind of intermediaries between the king and the lower levels of the hierarchy? Anybody remember? I'll give you a really big hint. The story of the Franks in the Dark Ages, when the Merovingians tried to rule this growing empire of theirs after the fall of Rome. Keen?
Were they the mayors of the palace?
The mayors of the palace.
Name like that.
Right, and they belonged to what dynasty that took over after the Merovingians?
I can't remember.
Oh, Karol the Great was the leader of? Based on his name. Alexander?
The Carolingians,
yes, good. The Carolingians, remember. So, right, the mayors of the palace in the Frankish kingdom was definitely that kind of official. And there's a great, you know, intrigue and conspiracy in Frankish history about the mayors of the palace taking over from the do-nothing kings. Right? So there's a good example, again, of a pattern, right? We're looking for, in when we're trying to find the instructional values in history, we're looking for patterns, we're looking for things that repeat, right? That show us a general truth that in hierarchical systems like this, that in which power is distributed, okay? In a hierarchical society in which power is distributed, power corrupts at every level. And that means that the system is always, it's inherently unstable. Because at every level you have somebody that has power that, finish the sentence. Yeah, at every level you have somebody that has power that, Theo?
That canon will be corrupted.
Okay, and because he's going to be corrupted, he's going to want more...
Power,
right. And how do you get more when there's only a set amount?
You take it from someone else.
Yeah, you got to take it from somebody else. Next to you, above you in the hierarchy, preferably, right? So the system is a... It's a very... Well, all right, I have to be careful about over-philosophizing with you guys here. But, you know, if it's a system of the hierarchy of power, I mean, what is that, the fundamental relationship between human beings in this kind of society? What is it like? What's the character of the relationship between people? That's a tough question. That's going really philosophical, right? What's the quality of the bonds in society? What are the bonds that keep society together? Right? Between the various levels of the hierarchy. How do they work? Difficult to articulate, but Theo is basically right that there's always a dimension of this struggle for power. There's always that dimension in relationships. So it's very malevolent, right? You always are in a relationship that's always going to have that dimension to it, some aspect of political power in your relationship, which is really sad. And the freer societies get, the more individuals are liberated from that type of relationship. And we get to look at each other not as, you know, potential rulers and potential overlords. We look at each other, especially in a modern society in which you have more freedom, we look at each other as fellow citizens, and we respect each other's life and property, and we trade with each other benevolently. The whole character of our relationships shifts towards a more benevolent aspect. To the extent that relationships in a society are based on physical force, then you have a malevolent system and it's bound to fall apart. The better, the more, the freer the relationships, the more benevolent the relationships in a society between people, the more successful the society, the more the society allows people to flourish. So anyway, that was me, again, going to that philosophical level to get you to kind of contend with that here. All right, but let's talk about Pharaoh's viziers. We've got this very delicate relationship here. Okay, and I gave you an example of a European one in which we have the mayors of the palace with the Frankish kings. In more modern European societies, in the more bureaucratic modern governments, what you see is that countries have what are called prime ministers. Have you guys ever noticed that this is a term that, you know, in societies that are, you know, non-American, right? Have you ever wondered, why do other countries have prime ministers instead of presidents? Right? What's that? Well, because the kings would have, oh my goodness, Canadians are voting today. Okay, so yeah, they're going to vote on their prime minister. Or soon, anyway. Okay, thanks, Nemo. Yeah, I'll have to pay attention to that. Anyway, prime minister, I mean, the idea of ministers was that as the government that involved kings got to be more and more complicated, let's cut out the chat for now, guys, please. Okay. As governments involving kings got to be more bureaucratic, they got to be more organized and more complicated. It became really important for the kings to delegate the organization of all of these so-called ministries, these various groups or agencies within the government that are performing different functions, and to delegate the organization of each ministry to a character known as a minister. And then within that hierarchy, of course, there came to be so many ministers as the government performed a variety of functions. And then so you, at the top of that, you get a prime minister, the highest ranking of them, of what sometimes is called a cabinet. And that, you know, that can be, that meaning is also extended into American politics and so on. So, and you get this character at the top who is the main leader of the government in every practical function. He's called the prime minister. And then in some societies, you get mixes. You get somebody who's called the president, somebody who's also a different guy who's the prime minister, and it just becomes kind of goofy, really, at the top. Anyway, that's the main terminology in modern government. We have this delegation, but what's happened in societies like England, like Canada, like Australia, and other European societies as well, is that eventually the king just basically became divorced from the real exercise of power, and the prime minister became the elected official, not appointed by the king anymore, but instead elected by the populace. And so the real person in charge. So kind of a different system, different arrangement. But again, you've got this hierarchy at the top, this two-pronged hierarchy, the pharaoh and the vizier, or in a European type system, the king and the prime minister. And then gradually over time, in European societies, the authority shifted to the office of the prime minister. All right, so there's another connection to Europe. Let's look at right now the next level. And we're not gonna look at the details of Egyptian religion because it is extinct. So when we study, you know, the struggles within Christendom, European Christendom in European history, there's a present-centric element there because Christianity is still the most important religion in the world. It has changed a lot over time, but some of the medieval issues, you know, still are very telling, are still very revealing about the way that the church works and is organized and so on. So we study that. We're not going to study Egyptian religion in any detail. We are interested, though, in kind of the general structure of the society and some of its, you know, the functions over here and their relationships and so on. But what I want to focus on today is the next level down right here, which is, again, concerned with the reality of power. So if you want to make a comparison, the most apt comparison between that layer and European society is over here, right? Again, between the kings, and for those of you who have studied it in history at our house, I call it the problem of the dukes. Does anybody remember that in European history? The problem of the dukes. What am I referring to here? In this, again, this hierarchy of power. Theo already told us kind of the general rule. At every layer, people have a certain amount of power and are corrupted by it and are seeking more of it. So what was the problem of the dukes? Go, you want to say it again, Theo? Go ahead.
Well, I don't entirely remember what the problem of the dukes was, but I think it was something like, they were powerful enough that they could overthrow the king very rapidly.
Okay, especially if they worked in concert with each other, right? Yeah. And so, yeah, it was the problem of European feudalism was the reality that the king is really only one of the dukes, is really only one of the lords, only has a certain amount of territory. And so the others agree that he's going to become the king, but he's really only one among equals. And so his authority was distributed through them. And if they chose to rebel against him, well, throughout the Dark Ages, there was nothing the kings could do. And it took, it took a good 1,000 years for European kings to start developing a bureaucratic system of government to overcome that. The French kings were the first to do it. The German kings never really managed to do it until it was too late. And in various societies, the kings tried to solve this problem of the fact that they are in the castle, the palace, wherever, right? This one location, wherever they are. And they're trying to rule a large society. Well, the reality is, of course, that they have to delegate and that the people beneath them in the hierarchy also have to delegate to regional officials. So, you know, this is another very interesting and universal problem in governments, in any society, you name it, even modern ones. This challenge of regionalism, this challenge of how to, you know, maintain government over a large geographical extent, given the, you know, the limitations of how human institutions work, how do you do it? How do you get that king who's sitting in one place? How does he rule the whole thing? How does he really do that, right? Because we use words. We say, the king is the monarch. Oh, yeah? That means the rule of one. What do you mean by that? Really? How does that work? Really? And then now we have to get past kind of a very elementary conception of these things and think about the details. The king relied on a vast hierarchy beneath him. And in both the European system and in the archaic Egyptian system and in the feudal Japanese system and so on and every other one that you can see, every other one, there came to be, there's always this structural problem of what to do with these characters. Because if you look within the hierarchy, necessarily, look at everything that is underneath them. Within their local regions. In a European, for a European duke, we would call it a duchy. For a European count, we would call it a county. For the lords of ancient Egypt that we refer to in modern history as nomarchs, the territory was a nome. So, just an administrative division, a region, a territory where the Lord has direct power. I mean, much more direct, right? The power of the king is distributed through these nomarchies. Goodness, it's hard to say. Okay? So they're all... Now, why do they participate in any monarchy, the nomarchs? How does this relationship work up here at the very, very top? Now, Menes Narmer conquers all of these nomarchs, right? He comes down to Lower Egypt and he establishes his rule. Okay. But then, if you're going to have a dynasty and if you're going to have a kingdom, they're going to buy in. What's the buy-in? You know, how does this society function at all? Who would want to be a nomarch? Juliet?
Because they get paid taxes from the people.
Okay, partly. Now they got to pass in. So they're probably going to be in charge of localized taxation. And so there's a lot of responsibility there. And they got to pass that on up to the pharaoh. Okay, but they get to keep some of that, presumably, right? I mean, they're in a better position than the rest of the people because, well, they are higher up in the hierarchy than everybody else. So they get a certain amount of power. Alexander?
And like you said, they get a certain amount of power over their local region. Well, they can pretty much do anything they want unless the pharaohs or the vizier says that they can't. So there's like a certain rules that they have to follow, and if like the pharaoh or the vizier, if they want to go to war or something, then they probably have to provide soldiers or whatever. But otherwise, like in the day-to-day affairs, they pretty much have all the local power.
Right, exactly. The reality of the situation is the pharaoh is far away. Or there's an expression in Chinese culture, the emperor is far away. I forget the whole expression, but it's the same sentiment, right? The pharaoh is, don't worry about the pharaoh, right? This is real life down here. Okay. And so to be a nomarch is to be in a really great spot. You don't have to worry about the whole country. You get to have power over your local, you know, population. It's still a delicate operation. Right? Because you can't be a tyrant either. Or somebody will report up the hierarchy to the vizier. The pharaoh will find out. He'll come and he'll depose you. Or he'll collect up the other local nomarchs and send them to take over your territory. So it's a delicate operation. But it's a good spot to be in because you don't have to organize the whole thing. And you got local, real local power. And interesting situation. A lot like the dukes in the Dark Ages. You've got your own castle. You've got your own army. You have your own local taxation mechanism. You have a pretty good life. And you don't have to worry. You don't have to have the headaches of controlling the whole country. Right. But the problem with the nomarchs and the problem with the dukes in European feudalism is they want more power. They don't necessarily... You know, they're not clueless. They know how the system works. They know the pharaoh. They know the vizier. They know how the whole arrangement works. So they are bound to be more cynical, more power-oriented types of characters, kind of what we might call realists, or you know, not naively following the system. You're not going to find any of the Nomarchs who actually think the Pharaoh is a god, right? That kind of piety is something that the priests can kind of pull off with the slaves and the lower peoples and so on. But these guys are at the top and they know the deal. They know how society really works. And so they are dangerous. They're dangerous because they've got local power. And you have to really watch out how much of it that they have. Does anybody remember, to again draw a comparison to Europe, anybody remember William the Conqueror in English history? Got a few. And what was interesting about his story in relation to the problem of the dukes? In 1066, William conquers England. And Alexander?
Well, he was the Duke of Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a duke under the French king, but he was also the king of England himself.
Yes.
And realistically, he had, because of like the whole problem of the dukes, and the king actually had very little power compared to like what you usually think of as kings. And so the Duke of Normandy, who's also the King of England, had quite a bit more power than the King of France, except the King of France is still supposed to be his king, but he's also the King of England, so he doesn't have to follow another king.
All right, now you're working on the French-English angle, but because the Duke of Normandy knew about this problem, what did he do in England was my question. So he had a lot of experience being the troublemaker, being a duke who makes headaches for a king. So now he is a king. How did he organize his kingdom, Theo?
Well, I'm remembering that he made all of the duchies really, really small.
Mm-hmm, right. He divided up the kingdom into much smaller regions so he could limit how much land any of the lords had and thus make it much more difficult for them to conspire against him. Right? All right. So, good. Just wanted to bring that comparison back as well. Because what we find at the end of the Age of Pyramids, and the chronology, I'm gonna really focus on the chronology tomorrow, okay? But at the end of the Age of Pyramids, what we get is a really old pharaoh, according to Egyptian records, 96 years old. His name is Pepi II. And it's a funny-sounding name, certainly. And if that helps you to remember, great. But anyway, the key is, of course, that he's old and frail. And you have to imagine what is the relative, you know, position of the pharaoh and the vizier in a relationship like that. What are the intrigues that characterize the royal household as people are positioning themselves for his inevitable passing? And if you can combine such a very difficult situation with drought, which places a lot of stress on the society and causes mass starvation, and it really disrupts the function of government, well, you end up with a perfect storm, as they say. The Egyptian system crumbles. The Egyptian pharaonic system falls apart because at the lower ranks, the viziers and the nomarchs are basically all running around trying to figure out who's going to take power. How is this society going to function? And what ends up happening is an extended period of civil war because there isn't a clear successor. There isn't a real powerful pharaoh who can control the system underneath him, a real charismatic leader who can control the system. So it falls apart. And the Egyptian historian Manetho probably is exaggerating when he says, but it's still very poetic, and we'll end on this note. He says that following the rule of Pepi II, there were 70 kings in 70 days. So, I don't think we need to take that literally, but we can get the meaning, right? Chaos, civil war, nomarchs, viziers, priests, warriors, whoever, right? All of these members of the hierarchy scrambling to figure out how, who is going to put this back together again? Because it's so dependent on the maintenance of the pharaonic mystique, the maintenance of this pharaonic, the symbolic monarchy. When that shatters, everything underneath crumbles, or there's kind of a, we could call it a vacuum of power, right? And it sucks everybody from the lower levels. They try to get up to the top, scramble over each other's corpses in order to be the ruler. All right, so like I said, tomorrow we'll look at the details of that. I'm going to plot out these crucial events for you on our timeline. So we'll look at kind of the particular dates and mechanics of Egyptian history. And we'll see that after the rule of Pepi II, there's no more pyramids. So Egypt becomes a very different kind of a country. Pretty much same religion, pretty much same society, still pharaohs and so on. But again, kind of the heart of it is hollowed out because the pharaonic system is the real problems of it, the real weaknesses are revealed. And so it becomes more pragmatic. It becomes kind of a harder thing for people to keep it going. And they're not as committed to it as they were before. So it's much more about power. Okay. That'll do it for today. This diagram I will post to the class webpage soon. I don't promise today because I might want to tweak it a little bit more before I make it official, so that you guys can download it and print it off and look at it on your own time. But pretty soon. Okay? That's it for now. Thanks, guys. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.